You're listening to the Faces of Armenia podcast.
Any authoritarian regime needs a foreign enemy. Aliyev needs for his people to hate Armenians more than they hate him. Erdogan needs people to hate in order to be inspired into this ultranationalism that he offers them. With a prolonged war, Armenia will need assistance. And when Armenia's need for assistance is extreme, Russia will demand concessions. Russia has been promoting this idea of Russian peacekeepers in Artsakh and in Armenia, a push for Russian military bases. So basically, you have the beginnings of military occupation.
This and more in today's episode.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends of Faces of Armenia, we welcome you today to another special series on Artsakh, in which we offer experts a platform to share their perspectives and reflect upon Nagorno-Karabakh. We hope that their perspectives will add to the substance of the ongoing discussions, as well as strengthen democratic and mediating forces, which will both hopefully contribute to a timely end of the war. We, Faces of Armenia, see ourselves as a bridge between Armenia and the international community, calling the latter to engage productively and to support humanitarianly in this crisis. Today, we have a very special guest, and I think you already know him, Mr. Vahan Bornazian, esteemed human rights lawyer teaching at the Yerevan State University currently. We already had one interview with him. However, much remained to be said. And today we offer interview part two, in which we will have a little zoom in on the framework, on different scenarios of the conflict and its future implications. So, as you already know, Vahan, I think we can dive right in. And Vahan, could you illuminate what different players are key in this conflict, both locally, regionally, and globally?
Very well, I'll do my best. So, locally, we see that we have the state, Armenian state, which as of 2018 had a successful transition from a very authoritarian regime to a much more democratic regime, because we had the best elections that we've ever had, free and fair elections, in December of 2018. And in Artsakh, we have the Armenian population of Artsakh that has been in that area for generations and generations and has successively and successfully exercised self-determination. I mean that there is a history of Artsakh population requesting to be reunited with Armenia after the Stalin borders put it within the Azerbaijan SSR, and that since 1991, when they declared their self-determination, the Armenians of Artsakh, they have been exercising self-governance. So the only thing, meaning that they are exercising self-determination, but without formal recognition from other states. The other parties involved. Well, we see that Azerbaijan is recognized as a state, but if we look at the human rights record, we see that the current regime of Aliyev has terrible human rights record, especially with regard to democracy, constant oppression of journalists and political opponents. And we also see that Azerbaijan includes many different minority groups. And so if we look closer, we see that, for example, Talish in the south of Azerbaijan have a closer affinity to Iran and Iranians than to Azerbaijan. And we see there's also different minority groups in the northern part of Azerbaijan. So what's interesting is that they could become actors. In other words, they could be inspired to, if there is significant instability, they could be inspired to take action on, to, in terms of self-determination of their own. And that's not unheard of. Like if we look for precedent, we see that in Georgia, for example, the Abkhazi region of Georgia, dissatisfied with the situation in Georgia, wanted to exercise self-determination, and then was included in Russia. And we see that, again, the Stalinist borders had divided the Ossetians into North Ossetia and South Ossetia, putting South Ossetia in Georgia. And we see that there was, in a way, a reunification of South and North, but within the Russian state. So it's not self-determination. But we could theorize that it's possible that Talish would become an actor and seek reunification with Iran or seek self-determination independently. We can theorize that some of the minority groups in the north, the other minority groups on the other side of the border with Russia. So that, I mean, Russia could manipulate that or use that in order to incorporate those areas into Russia. So there's local actors at that level. We also see other local actors appearing in Azerbaijan, like Syrian mercenaries, and they are connected with usually different religious affiliations.
Having Syrian mercenaries there, does it imply that Syria itself, can it be evaluated as being involved? Or is it that some splinter group, some Syrian minority that feels the need to engage in this conflict?
If we read the information that's been published and the interviews that have been done, because there's a number of journalists that have interviewed these Syrian mercenaries who are currently in Azerbaijan fighting against Artsakh. And all of the evidence shows that they're there because they were hired, and they don't have any interest in Azerbaijan, and they don't have any personal interest in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Artsakh. They're only there for economic reasons, and it was because the severe poverty in northern Syria. And so people were recruited with the promise of $1,500, $2,000, etc., per month by security firms in Turkey. So Turkish security firms hired these people. These people were, they're hired from the northern Syria sector, which is occupied by Turkey. So it's definitely a Turkish program. And they were transported through Turkey. So this is very much connected with the Turkish state. And how do we know that it's connected with the Turkish state? Because it's there's a past pattern. So when we look at evidence, we look for past patterns. So we see that Turkey hired the same Syrian mercenaries and sent them to Libya.
I would like to start from the beginning. Let's say you were one of the first journalists who actually wrote about the Syrian mercenaries being transported to the Nagorno-Karabakh region. I would like to know, when did you learn about this? And was it clear that there is going to be a large military operation, that's why they are taken, or it was not clear by that time?
Well, the rumor among the Syrian National Army factions dates back to July. that's when they started getting news in the factions that they would be deploying some men to Azerbaijan. And rumors are common in the factions, but this one kind of had staying power. And it was very similar to how the Libya rumors started, in terms of how they were gathering people and sort of preparing to go. But even the guys there said that they didn't know for sure that they'd be going to Azerbaijan until like a week before. So, you know, mid-September. I don't think it was clear that there was going to be a serious offensive, but it wasn't hard to see that that was in the plan at some point. The same in Libya, because when they sent the Syrians to Libya, it was like a month before the real serious attacks began. So, I mean, if the Syrians are going somewhere, if Turkey is sending the mercenaries somewhere, it's for an attack.
Did they know, like, they are going to fight Armenians, they are going to fight in Karabakh? What do you think they knew about that time?
They don't know what Karabakh is, and probably still don't. And in fact, when they heard it was sort of a different territory than Azerbaijan, one guy said it was an island, like Jazeera, meaning actually an island covered, you know, surrounded by water. They just had no idea of the region. Most of them couldn't pronounce Azerbaijan, couldn't point it out on a map. They were told that they would be border guards. Similar story that they were told in Libya, so I don't understand how they could possibly believe it, but they definitely didn't know that they'd be doing any hardcore fighting, or actually just kind of standing in as human shields, which is what they've been doing.
There's lots of evidence about Turkey hiring people and sending them to fight in Libya. Some of those same Syrians that were fighting in Libya were transferred to Azerbaijan. Others are new recruits from the same Turkish-controlled area of northern Syria. And I think that's just a terrible economic situation for those people.
I mean, let's dwell on this just a little bit. So Turkey, which is already like returned to a presidential system, curtailed like election rights and freedom of speech, if you want to say so. So one could argue, hey, you know, Turkey doesn't care about its popular image in the world. Why don't they send their own soldiers? Like instead of hiring mercenaries. So I see it as a covert operation. No one is supposed to know that Turkey is hiring them in the age of information technology, which is also surprising. So what were Turkey's incentives to disguise their financial or their actual human soldiers' support to Azerbaijan?
Well, my position is it's just cheaper to use people like this. And I understand that there would be like more political outrage, or there would be more to deal with on the diplomatic spectrum if Turkey were to send its own troops, which, by the way, there is some evidence coming out that Turkey does have troops in Azerbaijan. It has either advisors or more than that, because the information that came out yesterday was that right after the failed ceasefire, there was an attack on Hadrut, Armenian city in Artsakh. Hadrut is south of Stepanakert. So Stepanakert is the capital in the center of Artsakh, and Hadrut is south of that. So it's towards the Iranian border. So the attack in Hadrut, there were soldiers who were in a firefight in Hadrut, and Hadrut was, they were held off by the mayor and local residents holding off this attack until the Artsakh regular forces could arrive in order to aid in the defense. And the attackers were dispersed. And the report was that they were Turkish Special Army Unit. In other words, the information from yesterday is that Turkey is sending troops, and not only regular troops, but its own special service or special unit. If we look at public international law, the conflict is already internationalized, because when you have two regimes under public international law, one is for international conflict and one is for less than international, what they call non-international conflict. So if we consider that the Armenians of Artsakh are defending themselves in terms of in exercise of their self-determination against Azerbaijan, some could consider that a non-international conflict. But now we have Turkish troops and we have Turkish-funded mercenaries. I mean, in discussing with the mercenaries say that they were hired by Turkish security firms. They were transported through Turkey. And yes, many of them, or some of them at least, come from these religious-oriented military units. We would call them religious paramilitary units that exist in northern Syria in coordination or cooperation with Turkey as a state. And then these people show up on the other side. So we have internationalization of the conflict. But I think that we were getting to who the actors are, and I was going through the local actors. And in Azerbaijan, in terms of local actors, there's reports that need to be further clarified about Pakistan having sent troops or mercenaries. And there was a report that there was an agreement between Turkey and one of the current political military forces in Afghanistan to join in the fight in Azerbaijan. So it's becoming more and more internationalized as the information starts to
come out. For our audience to understand this fact better, what are the implications of the involvement of Syria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan?
The implication only is that the conflict is internationalized, and these involvements show some kind of religious affiliation or some religious component. And that's also dangerous because we've seen that this religious fanaticism drives ethnic cleansing and it drives genocide. So let's take a look at some local history in terms of ethnic cleansing and genocide in the recent, very recent past. So we saw that the Islamic State wreaked havoc in Syria and Iraq, and the Islamic State perpetrated a genocide against Yazidis. It's very well known. We also know that the Turkish state was funding the Islamic State. It was funding the Islamic State, and it was providing, the fighters from the Islamic State were being treated in Turkish hospitals. So there was a very organized method of participation. And we see that Erdogan keeps fomenting this religious aspect. He keeps describing Turkey as the new representative of Islam. He relies on religion, and he accommodates religious fanaticism, if not encourages it, because it's an easy way to say that you are doing something for your population when the economy is falling apart. So when the rulers or the regime doesn't provide anything to the population, it feeds them a narrative of religious superiority, of religious glory, or of ultranationalism. And this ultranationalism or this religious fanaticism, they are in. And we see that they lead to ethnic cleansing. That's why we saw the ethnic cleansing or genocide of Yazidis in Iraq. And we also saw that in terms of not the religious component, but the ethnic component when Turkey invaded northern Syria, because it attacked the Kurdish autonomous communities. Northern Syria, when there was a power vacuum and the Kurdish populations in northern Syria started to exercise self-governance. They started to exercise self-determination. They did not declare it. They were exercising self-rule de facto by default, but they organized themselves into a unique system of egalitarian rule by committee. And you can read about Rojava in northern Syria, and it's quite impressive what they were able to accomplish in a very participatory manner. And Turkey really didn't want for there to be Kurdish autonomous self-governing communities because it could inspire Kurds in Turkey. So we have, again, about the local actors, we have to recognize that most of Eastern Turkey now is Kurdish. And so, and we've seen that...
Okay, then quickly to interject, what is the relationship of Kurdish people to Armenians?
So I think that we should recognize that Kurds and Yazidis are ethnically the same, but that the difference between Yazidis and Kurds is the religious component. So they come from the same ethnic background, but the Kurds are Muslim. So that could explain why the genocide by the Islamic State in Iraq was against the Yazidis, but didn't go further into the same act against Kurds. Mm-hmm. But the Kurdish people in Eastern Turkey have been demonstrating for more self-rule and have been continuously oppressed. And I should say, actually, that due to their oppression, they've been protesting for self-rule in response to that oppression. And it's well documented. You can go do any reading on human rights and find it. And we see that in Turkey, right before September 27th, when the war started, so in August and September, we see Erdogan starting to arrest Kurdish leaders. So it was an effort to, knowing that he was going to create instability, he was an effort to control that population by arresting its leadership. And this is a tactic that we've seen repeated again and again. For example, the beginning of the Armenian genocide started with the arrest of all Armenian leadership. And it was the arrest of the Armenian leadership, and it was then the conscription of Armenian men, and then it was the deportation and genocide of women and children. So there's a practice. So arresting leadership of a community is a way to leave the community disorganized so that you can continue to control and oppress it. And I think that the fear that Kurds can exercise self-determination in Eastern Turkey was why Turkey invaded northern Iraq to destroy the autonomous Kurdish communities there, and why it works well with jihadist or radicalized Muslims in Syria for that aim. But there's also an economic component. People are suffering from poverty, and that's why they feel compelled to enlist.
And then, so what we would need to understand, do you think the main actor or aggressor on, like, looking on the Turkish side of the equation is Erdogan, or are there any other key players, A? And B, does Erdogan, like, he obviously acts like from a religious perspective and megalomania maybe, but secondly, does he arrest, is he scared, is he insecure, if we like have a psychological analysis of his personality?
I think it's actually the opposite. I think that it's very logical for ultranationalists to be expansive and imperialistic. So again, I go to the point that his party serves its oligarchy in its country. Erdogan himself is an oligarch.
Mm-hmm.
So they're interested in... Erdogan serves his own financial interests and the financial interests of other oligarchs. He does zero for the population, and the economy is falling apart. So people's standard of living is going down. So he needs a distraction, and all authoritarians use the distraction of the foreign enemy, the foreign threat, and the glory of empire or the glory of religion. So it's a classic case. It's not strange at all. It's just out of control. We see him, taking aggressive action against Greece.
What's stoking tensions between these two NATO allies is the discovery of energy reserves off the coasts of Cyprus, Israel, and Egypt. Turkey has occupied the northern half of Cyprus since 1974 and claims it has the right to search for oil in Cyprus's waters.
Yunanları dökeceğim denize. Evet.
Under the divisive rule of President Erdogan, Turkey has already begun drilling illegally.
Well, unfortunately, Turkey is conducting illegal drilling activities within the exclusive economic zone of Cyprus. Whenever a top official from Turkey makes a statement, it's a statement that involves talk of war. War in Syria, war in the Middle East, war in the Frates region, war in the West, war in the East, war in the Aegean. Now, if that is not aggressive rhetoric, then I'm wondering what type of rhetoric it is.
Aggressive action against Cyprus. I mean, Turkey has occupied northern Cyprus, and now the one area that was closed, they're trying to reopen, or they are reopening. So they're reopening a beach in northern Cyprus, yeah, which is basically a territorial claim. So they're expanding, they're doing these little things to instigate conflict. And I think that Aliyev has the same problem as Erdogan, a faltering economy. Everyone knows that he's oppressive, because he cannot maintain power otherwise. He's built this pyramid scheme. And when you build a pyramid, it's exclusionary. You're always excluding people and funneling all the wealth to the top. And you always have to be expansive. You know, you need more people at the bottom, or you need to get rid of the people at the bottom. And war is always good distraction. This is just common knowledge, and it's a distraction. It feeds into nationalism, and people are inspired to make sacrifices, whether by sacrificing their lives in military service or just making economic sacrifices for the good of the community. It's a natural response. So it heightens nationalism. And I think that for these reasons, there is a logic. It's a devious logic, and it shows that it's a logic of authoritarianism. So what we see is just two authoritarian states, Turkey and Azerbaijan, wanting to eliminate a democratic counterpart. Because if we look at the autonomous Kurdish communities in northern Syria, there they set precedent. They act as an example, and they could inspire other Kurds to seek autonomy, self-determination. We see Armenia having a movement to oust authoritarian regime and to start a more democratic a system of governance whereby we had the best elections we ever had and our democracy is solidifying. And then we see Belarus, people trying to protest bad elections. Everyone knows that the leader is not genuine, not elected, and they're trying to instigate change, reform, oust an authoritarian. Mm-hmm. Other authoritarians fear democratic movements. Democratic movements are a threat to authoritarians. So you cannot allow these democratic examples to inspire others.
So then let me interject here. How prepared are the main actors, which I would describe as Turkey and Azerbaijan, how prepared are they to commit another genocide?
So if we see that, talking about examples, Artsakh as in Artsakh exercising self-determination is an example for other minority groups in Azerbaijan that have the same claim. So Aliyev thinks that he needs to eliminate that example so that other minority groups don't get the same idea. And when rule is based on oppression, there's no limits to the oppression. Past in terms of the Armenian genocide, but it's associated with genocide of the Yazidis because it was funding and supporting the Islamic State. And it's associated with the destruction of free and autonomous communities in northern Syria. So it's belligerent. It has a recent current history of belligerence. The step from going from that belligerence to ethnic cleansing is very slight. We already see we see preparations for this by bringing in fanatical religious people, because that's like someone that you can use as a tool. You know, in all genocides, they use certain actors under some framework. So
in this regard, you're referring now to the Afghani, Syrian, Pakistani mercenaries.
Let me be clear that we only have evidence so far of the Syrian mercenaries that have joined for economic reasons and for religious reasons, depending on the people.
What incentive prevails? What would you say? Is it more of an economic rationale or religious?
So we have evidence of both so far. So I can't really speak to that. It depends on the person. There's people that are joining because of their fanatic religious position, and there's people joining because of economics. But
I'm sorry to interject one more time, because what is so concerning, the European Union, the US with their foreign policy, with their missions in other countries, they were supposed, or they want to promote prosperity, giving people economic opportunity. So one could eliminate the economic variable and only deal with the religious.
Yes. Yes, thank you for that. What's difficult here is that I don't want to make statements that I don't have evidence for, but I want to explain what evidence we have and let the listener work through to a conclusion themselves. And in order to do that, I suggest that you consider past practice and motivation. And we see Aliyev's motivation. He doesn't want an independent Artsakh that gives other minority groups in his country an idea of what they could also achieve. And Turkey has, you know, stated that it wants to reestablish the Ottoman Empire, and it's very much positioning itself as quote unquote like leader of the Muslim world, and it wants to distract its own people from their own dire economic issues. And it's a huge manipulation. But Turkey is associated with genocide and continues to be associated with genocide, including the Yazidi genocide, including in northern Syria, and because there was an ethnic component. And now we have this ethnic conflict, which is also has an economic component because authoritarians need to distract their populations. And there's a democratic versus authoritarian component. The authoritarians don't want a democratic, free Artsakh as a symbol or an example for others. And other states in our region don't want a democratic Armenia, because a democratic Armenia is a symbol, an example, and a threat to the authoritarianism around us. That be Turkey, that be Azerbaijan, or that be Russia as well. So Russia is sitting in a very convenient position because all it does is need to wait. And with a prolonged war, Armenia will need assistance. And when Armenia's need for assistance is extreme, Russia will demand concessions. And I have information confidentially that they're already making their demands. And some of these demands are evidenced by their prior statements, where since in 2016, and I think also before 2016, Russia has been promoting this idea of Russian peacekeepers in Artsakh and in Armenia. And there's also a push for Russian military bases. So basically, you have the beginnings of a military occupation. And there's other demands with regarding governance. So we're looking at Russia sitting and eventually benefiting from any prolonged conflict. So if Europe is going to act, it needs to act now, because the longer the conflict goes, Armenia will be thrown more and more towards Russia and become more and more dependent on Russia for survival. And that just means that Russia will come in and prepare step by step towards some future Crimea point two, a second Crimea.
But I mean, I would say that it doesn't solve the conflict. That is equivalent to a continuation of the frozen conflict. Because
I think you're right, and I have to say that's the motive. You're pointing out something that is beneficial to those who practice divide and rule. Colonial powers continue to practice divide and rule. We assume that state actors would want there to be peace and stability. But there are state actors like Russia who has always benefited from a divide and rule policy in the Caucasus. So who says that Russia, Turkey, or even Aliyev in Azerbaijan want peace and security and some termination of the conflict, a final solution? They don't, because it's more advantageous to always have the foreign enemy. Any authoritarian regime needs a foreign enemy. Aliyev needs for his people to hate Armenians more than they hate him. Erdogan needs people to hate in order to be inspired into this ultranationalism that he offers them, because he offers them nothing else. Authoritarians need a foreign enemy in order to manipulate people. Democracies don't.
Okay, but then really this is I think very, very important. How I see it, and feel free to criticize me, to any resolution cannot include Russia, but would need to focus on Azerbaijan and Turkey. Because if Azerbaijan and Turkey revert from their fear of minorities like claiming self-determination, or stop their fear of Kurdistan having their own state, then Armenia could coexist with them comparatively peacefully. By which I want to say negotiations of any kind has to, at some point in time, focus on Azerbaijan and Turkey.
Sure, I agree. And I mean, we have proof of this, of what we're both talking about, in that from Friday to Saturday, there was 9 to 11 hours of negotiations to come up with a ceasefire agreement that had 4 points. And basically, it was to return to the platforms that already exist for negotiating a final settlement. And Azerbaijan agreed to it, continued shelling civilian areas up until the 12 o'clock point when which the ceasefire was supposed to begin. The ceasefire was supposed to begin Saturday at 12 noon. Up until that point, Azerbaijan was continuing to attack civilian populations. Then 5 minutes after 12 noon, Azerbaijan attacked again, and then we saw the armed attack on the ground towards in Hadrut. So it shows that they're not interested in negotiations, and it completely undermined the authority of Russian, the diplomatic clout of Russia. I mean, the authority of Russia as an intermediary was completely undermined when what was negotiated was completely ignored in 5 minutes' time. And so we do need global actors. We need the UN. We need the European Union. We need an actor of greater diplomatic clout in order to bring these parties to a peaceful settlement. But certain parties don't want peace. They profit from war, and they profit from conflict. And this is the problem that needs to be addressed by the world community.
So then, before we have a look on the world community, could you kindly compare and contrast Mr. Aliyev and Mr. Erdogan? And incentives, what incentives, what levers are at play in these two personalities? And if one were to find a common denominator, to find outlets in the respective countries in their respective systems, what could be an avenue? It doesn't have to be leadership, I want to be clear. It can also be, like, say, political society, economic society, or civil society. But specifically, where would Armenia see the greatest utility and benefit from launching a new and revised attitude and format to negotiations with what any appropriate outlet in the respective country?
There's a short-term answer and a long-term answer. I think that too often we only focus on the short term, but for the short term, we have to recognize the motivations. Erdogan and Aliyev are the same in that they're both authoritarian regimes because they've done a lot to undermine and limit any kind of democracy in their respective countries. And they serve their own financial interests and the financial interests of their co-oligarchs. And their economies are suffering. So what they do is they lash out against the world. It's almost, it's close to or getting close to like a North Korea type of situation. North Korea only knows to make threats, to be a troublemaker, in order to get concessions or to get some kind of legitimacy or some type of economic advantage. And with sanctions, there are sanctions against Turkey now. And so they're lashing out, causing trouble in order to get the attention of the community, as well as to make money off of war, and as well as to distract their local populations, feeding them ultra-nationalism and religious fervor. And those are the motivations that anyone in the international community needs to address. So when you're dealing with a bully, the only way to deal with a bully is to act like a bully. So the simple answer would be Security Council action. So if we look at the Security Council, the main participants that have the veto power, the five countries with the veto power, have to join together in order to support a Security Council action that has real consequences for the authoritarian actors in this situation. So it has to be in Russia's interest too, because Russia has veto power, in order to, and actually considering the damage to Russian diplomatic clout right now, it would be best for Russia to bring something to the Security Council and negotiate some kind of real action. That's the short term. I don't see, economic sanctions are already applied against Turkey. If you apply more economic sanctions against Turkey, you're just going to hurt the population more. I don't see that you hurt the population enough to the point that it rebels against Erdogan, because it's too invested and distracted in the nationalism and the religious fervor. But there has to be a more drastic intervention. The other issue is, I guess the long-term perspective is that we always need to be doing democracy building everywhere, because peace and security comes through democratic governance. Because democratic governance serves the populations, so it eliminates when rulers or when elected officials govern with the consent of the population, and there's periodic elections, they have to be accountable to the population. Authoritarian regimes are not accountable to the population. And so there's always going to be a manipulation of the population based on nationalism and religion and other factors.
But then two direct questions that come up. How invasive is the brainwashing caused by ultranationalism, propaganda, etc.? And two, do you think that civil society in either country can approach their leadership and voice any discomfort with the current stance on Armenia and Artsakh in a very well-worded manner?
This is an excellent question. And from what I understand about the information that is available, the information available about the human rights situation in Azerbaijan shows that civil society itself is oppressed. Political opposition is oppressed. Minority groups are oppressed. They're excluded from any access and any potential influence over the decision making of the state. So I don't see any possibility there. In Turkey, there is a vibrant civil society. It is also suffering since the alleged coup of years ago, which was used as an excuse to exclude people, to take academics out of academic positions. There's an attack on academics in Turkey, Turkish academics. Mm-hmm. So that also equates to an attack on diverse perspectives, diverse viewpoints, and an attack on civil society actors. So civil society actors, when they're always on the defensive, it's difficult to take an offensive position and make a statement. But I was told that a few days after the war began in late September, that one of the top trending hashtags in Turkey was "We are all Armenians." And this goes back to Hrant Dink, who was Turkish Armenian newspaper publisher who was assassinated in Istanbul, and the progressive Turkish society organized and condemned his assassination, and they started this "We Are All Armenians" movement, and it means that it shows solidarity with Armenians, and these are progressive Turks, and we must believe that there is a population which is progressive. There is a population which knows what's happening. But the extent to which they can organize and have impact on leadership is doubtful at this point, because we have just had so many years of oppressing civil society and the frameworks for people to make express their views. It's a hard situation. I don't really foresee how civil society in these authoritarian regimes can have impact, which is why democratic actors need to continue to support progressive democratic movement in these authoritarian societies. We need to find ways to help. But look right now, Belarus, the people of Belarus are demanding democratic reform. And that needs to be supported if it's going to succeed. And it's not an interference in terms of public international law, because the fundamentals of human rights and self-determination are superior to this question of state interference. Many times authoritarians will say that they're exercising sovereignty and any interference from an outside actor is an infringement on state sovereignty. But if you look at the UN Charter, to which all states are members, Article 55 of the UN Charter says that the purpose of the UN is to create peace and stability through human rights and democracy. And Article 56 says that all states pledge to contribute to that mission, either jointly or separately. So that means that every state has an obligation to support human rights and democracy everywhere, all the time. And so you cannot label as outside interference in your sovereignty any UN action that is founded in human rights and democracy.
So let me make a very interesting observation. Most authoritarians remember the Cold War. In the Cold War, there was a very prominent legal clause or legal agreement, and the agreement of mutual assured destruction in order to keep a world order, if one may say so. Now, during this MAD, how we call it, there was the general tenor that you do what you want in your country. We will not interfere in internal politics. However, we will interfere in foreign politics, such as MAD. And that was globally accepted, I would assume so. And now all these authoritarians come from a time of the World War. So they are used to, I can do whatever I want in my country, and you, the foreign country, say the European Union, US, you have no right to interfere, even if I kill, torture, incarcerate my people, limit freedom of speech. So maybe it is really the generation of the ruling class. Do you see this argument has any merit?
There's two ways to live in the world. You either live in the world by power and hierarchy, or you live in the world by rights. So it's so interesting that authoritarians choose this power perspective, and they dismiss as quaint and ineffective and surreal or not real human rights and democracy, yet they're always claiming rights. They're always claiming that they have a right and that they are exercising a right or they are defending a right. Yet the hypocrisy is just tangible because all of their conduct shows that they exercise, that they live by authority and power alone. And what we've learned from World War I and World War II is that this is a map, a roadmap towards mutual destruction. And maybe there's some actors that sell arms, that produce arms, that find this convenient. But I think that the framework of rights, the United Nations, any regional organization that's founded in rights, like the Council of Europe, the EU, this framework of rights, it works domestically, internally, but we know that it will only survive when it's accepted and valued globally. The premise of the United Nations is that in order to create peace and stability, there has to be democracy and human rights everywhere, and it has to be universal. Because if it's not, then there will be conflict, and that conflict will always expand purposefully or not so, and it will cross borders, and it has. So now that we're talking about, you know, this long-term perspective, is that all authoritarianism anywhere is a threat to democracy and human rights everywhere. And because we have so many states now that have limited democracy, have compromised democracies, or worse than compromised, we have a UN forum which is more about this old school international affairs than it is about rights. So we can't trust only states to be the actors. I think the short-term and the long-term solution to Armenia, Artsakh, and conflict here and conflict anywhere is a highly involved civil society on a global scale. You cannot trust states to do what's right. I want to just bring a history lesson that during the slave trade, the governments of the European countries and the Americas were fine with the slave trade, and it was only stopped because civil society in all of these countries was not fine with the slave trade. And the abolitionists worked to defeat slavery and force their governments to act. It's the same way with
Okay, but I can interject here. One has to acknowledge, and this is very important. So I think the liberation of human rights really came coincidentally with the Industrial Revolution around the time. And there was, if you all remember, a big famine that swept over Europe, and suddenly there was like too little labor, and landlords were in the minority, which gave the perfect storm of the people's civil society to become strong, to demand rights, to become like the like leaders of the country by the principle of universal suffrage. Now, there's a very clear line between Western Europe, let's say like sort of Poland, if you draw a long line, and further to the east. Further to the east, human rights took a much longer time to develop, and like the submission of civil society was much more prevalent. People had a much harder life, especially also if you look at the history in Russia. And this is instructive because, yes, sure, civil society is important, but that we have such a clear line. I mean, no human is better or worse, you know, in aggregate. It just shows that civil society, to become effective, needs an environment in which it can blossom, or yeah, at least start to blossom.
So if we look at the recent Soviet history, it confirms in a way what you're saying, because there was this perestroika and glasnost, which caused an opening, which allowed for people to start to participate in their societies in a genuine context. And we saw Armenians, for example, protesting and making demands for a cleaner environment, for example. That was the first movement. The movement was for a cleaner environment. And then the movement also came to support the rights of Armenians in Artsakh. And then it became an independence movement. But it started with an issue that was core to everyone, a clean environment. And it was because there was an opening, and that opening was created because of the Helsinki Accords. And it was also that the Soviet authorities agreed to the Helsinki Accords because they couldn't maintain the status quo any longer. I think we could say that the pyramid was collapsing. They needed that. They needed more openness or more interaction abroad. But I don't want to say that, I don't want us to have the impression that there's some cultural component to this, because we see universally that people have basic notions about what is just. And people, it starts with the individual. The individual knows when they're treated unfairly. The individual has a sense of dignity. Now, sometimes, because of cultural frameworks, we learn to accept a certain limits on our dignity. But people know unfairness, and people throughout the world have always been joining together in movements to stand up in protest against the unfairness that they experience. So it's a natural phenomenon outside of any cultural framework. But we saw that the civil movements after glasnost and perestroika, or coming with that, had more results. But it doesn't mean that there weren't protesters in the Soviet Union before that, that there wasn't some civil society action, even though the state tried to control everything. Because in the 1960s in Armenia, you had civil protests or demonstrations, which resulted in, for example, the genocide memorial being constructed. It was in 65. So even during the Soviet Union, there were occasions when people were activated by certain issues of justice. I think that what I was trying to say was that at this moment, what we need are civil society, the mobilization of civil society. For example, today I just signed a petition. People get online petitions, they promote them and they sign them. We have international civil society actors. We have Amnesty International. We have Human Rights Watch. And a lot of the groundwork that's done by the civil society actors, whether local or international, informs the United Nations. It informs the Council of Europe about what's happening, and it pushes these regional institutions into action. State bodies don't act until the populations push them to act. That's my point. And that pushing has to be local, domestic, and international. So if we're talking to our audience, if you're interested in civil rights and social justice, you have to find ways to act locally on both the local issues and the international issues, because if we as civil society ignore the civil society, human rights, democratic issues of others and other places, our whole world situation deteriorates. We have to be proactive on all fronts.
I think that gives us a very good segue into like the next very important part of the interview, the international environment. But one comment on my end, I think this is really a call to search and identify critical junctures in time, critical junctures in the political civil society environment in order to capitalize down on them, and to have then the international community involved in order to magnify, so to speak, a grassroots movement that can provoke change. Quick summary. We talked about regional actors who are intimately involved in the conflict. We identified, obviously, Azerbaijan, Turkey, Russia. Azerbaijan can be very well seen through the lens of self-determination of minorities, which may claim to become, like, to proclaim independence, of which Azerbaijan is scared. Turkey, on the other hand, offers an ultra-nationalist narrative and also involves fighters in predominantly Syria, even though we have a hunch that Afghanistan and Pakistan may also be involved. The good observation is that Turkey has some civil rights momentum going on. Maybe that can be ultimately serve as the stage for a broader connection for a effective negotiation. Russia, on the other hand, just failed in their ceasefire negotiation. It's a, so to speak, diplomatic embarrassment. And Russia will always be interested in one way or another in regional instability so that it can sell its overpriced security. But now that we understood and shone light on the regional actors to this conflict, can you please reflect upon the international environment, of which there is the European Union, the United States, and others? The floor is all yours.
Well, I just want to mention that we haven't spoken about Iran yet. And Iran is a regional actor that has stated that it has its concerns, because there are Azeris in northern Iran, and so there's this issue of Azerbaijan making a claim to areas of northern Iran, and Iran benefits from an independent Armenia. And I mean, even if it's a democratic Armenia, Iran still benefits as long as Armenia is strong enough to keep the Azeris occupied. In other words, Iran will have more problems in the future should Azerbaijan be stronger and not have to deal with Artsakh and Armenia. And And that's another issue. But about international actors, you said United States, you said European Union, yes?
And others. I think others you can check.
Well,
just in a bucket.
The United States is absent, missing, and self-absorbed. And that's a whole nother analysis. I mean, the very quick and easy analysis is that President Trump has property interests in Istanbul, Baku, and Moscow, and has no property interest in Armenia or Artsakh. But beyond that, the U.S. seems super distracted with its own internal domestic affairs coming up to the election and the COVID pandemic.
So, I mean, we are aware of this, but what we would want to understand, if the U.S. would become interested, what levers are available? What strategies can they pursue?
It's interesting because U.S. is part of the Minsk group, which is supposed to be finding a solution, a long-term solution to this issue. And but the U.S. has already imposed sanctions against Turkey. So the question is, what else could the U.S. do? It already has sanctions against Turkey. Will it increase sanctions against Turkey? Or is it the opposite, that the U.S. has to make a deal with Erdogan that they will remove the sanctions if Erdogan lays off? Because maybe Erdogan is just creating havoc in his neighborhood until he gets some concession, and the concession that he wants is sanctions removed. It's possible. The EU, I guess the EU doesn't want Turkey to release its refugee population to the West. And some EU actors may have interest in petroleum or oil, which comes from Baku, and or goes, there's a pipeline going through Azerbaijan and Georgia and Turkey. So there might be oil interests, economic interests, but the EU has already taken a stand against Turkey, or the EU and the Council of Europe have taken stands against Turkey because of its authoritarianism and suppression of human rights. So what else can they do? I mean, is this Erdogan still acting out in order to get attention and to get concessions? So I think that we need we really need Security Council action from the United Nations. And it needs to be something more than sanctions. The Security Council can act in other ways. The Security Council created international criminal tribunals, and we have had ethnic cleansing, and we haven't had tribunals against the Islamic State, and we haven't had any kind of discussion about Turkey's role in supporting the Islamic State and therefore being tied to ethnic cleansing and genocide against Yazidis. So it needs to be, it could be a legal issue, some kind of consequence. We need accountability. So how do we create accountability? Create accountability through a legal process. Create accountability through, you don't create accountability through sanctions, in my opinion. It's hard to figure out what can be done other than the UN does have the ability to deploy a military force.
So do you think, would that be a preferred avenue to have blue helmets rather than Russian peacekeepers? And how do you think, what would be the implication of either or?
I think the Russian peacekeepers are just an occupation force. And the blue helmets would be different from that. I'm not sure. I haven't really thought it through. So I haven't thought of all the implications, but I'm just responding to your question about the international actors and what they can actually do. Because I'm...
One option would be via the Security Council to potentially intervene militarily. While I think both of us, like, unfortunately, believe that this is unlikely.
I think Russia would veto that.
Yeah.
So, because Russia wants its own peacekeeping force here.
Which brings me to the point, Europe is an amalgam of, 28 states, at least the European Union. So,
much more than that by now.
Okay, let's call it 35. Then the question becomes, obviously, not every country is really interested. And if you go via this established mechanisms, Security Council, Minsk Group, CSTO, then you will be vastly limited by the multitude of stakeholders which can veto, which can intervene, etc. But what are predominant players in Europe and what can individual nations do on their own? Maybe if you shine light, okay, the nation won't act, but like civil society in this specific country or the political class has like good leverage to start a new process.
France. So France is in the Minsk group, and France has been calling out Erdogan on the mercenary issue. So that's a way of creating accountability by at least calling him out, announcing that the information is public, announcing that it's a fact, and calling him out for being in violation of international humanitarian law. So that's a big step, what France has already been doing. And the issue is like, it's French society, it's French civil society that pushes this government to do this. And I want to say that civil society actors in other places need to be activated to push their government to take a stronger foreign policy position against authoritarianism as it's manifesting against the people of Artsakh. I mean, it's just a blatant war crime that these authoritarian forces indiscriminately bomb civilian populations and worse. I mean, we have evidence from yesterday that Turkey has troops on the ground. It's a violation. So, especially when used against civilians. So, I think that we just need more civic society intervention and force governments to take stronger positions.
But that's easy to say, but how to do it? I'm now a French citizen and I say, okay, I want to support, I want to like represent a strong civic society, but I'm like sitting, walking around. What can I, the French citizen, or okay, I'm not French, but you know, you get the gist. What can I actually do? How can I start? How can I make my government move in a country of 50 million?
There are already civil society organizations that know how to do this. The point is that people need to make civil society organizations that have a track record care about this issue. I mean, the issue of Artsakh. I mean, it's a very, very basic the issue of self-determination, a decision there can be no question about it. So it's an easy argument to make. I think that it's not only civil society actors, it's political parties. But one way to do it is to you know, student groups, for example. Student group, you learn the facts, you write a petition, you get colleagues, fellow students to sign the petition, you organize lectures, you organize like these online lectures, you organize lectures in your university, you go and you meet with your politicians if you live in a democratic country. So you go and you meet and you advocate for them to take the position. I mean, we already have some really strong statements from European politicians in the recent EU parliamentary meetings, I believe. So the issue is not unknown. The question is demanding governments to act. And governments only act when the population demands them to.
Okay, then, like, I mean, we have a very good example, I think, right in front of Europe's doorstep, Belarus. How is Europe's attitude to Belarus instructive in regards to Artsakh?
I'm not so familiar with Europe's attitude towards Belarus. What have they done?
I mean, essentially, there is no intervention. There's...
So what they're saying is that they're recognizing, so far, so far, they're saying that they're recognizing Russian dominance in its sphere. They're letting the Russians handle it, which means that they're abandoning the Belarusian people. And what's going to happen is that that's going to be oppressive of civil society and democratic movements everywhere. And it just allows authoritarianism to grow. And I think that civil society needs to hold its politicians accountable, because sometimes politicians are corrupt. A couple of years ago, it was discovered that Azerbaijan was actually running a slush fund to pay for perks for European politicians. It was just courting European politicians by paying for them different things, and that needs to be exposed. And you need to go to your representatives and you need to demand them to recognize a very clear basic human rights and democratic issue and impress upon them that when they don't, authoritarianism grows. If the European Union doesn't take a strong stand on Belarus, then you're not going to have democratic movements anywhere else. How are you going to have a democratic movement in Russia when European Union doesn't take a stand on Belarus? It's a domino effect. And you know what? I'm sorry, but no one needs petroleum anymore. We have wind power and we have solar power, and we can come up with lots of other alternatives. Why are we allowing the petroleum economics to control the world?
I think this is a very instructive lesson, and I think it exemplifies of what is at stake. What is at stake is essentially human freedom and the rights to express yourself. Because if Europe can't stay even strong in their like front yard, what will happen to the world as a question? So as we shone light on Europe and the US, are there any other interesting, potentially valuable players internationally that don't include either of them?
China is silent. China is one of the big five on the Security Council. This would be an opportunity for China to gain clout. I think that Armenia has always had a relationship with China, and we know that China is authoritarian, so we're not appealing to China to act based on any kind of ideological affinity. But it's an opportunity for them to insert themselves in the region. I don't know. China is a big question mark. It's always preoccupied with its internal issues, but I think right now, for the international actors that are positive, we have France, and I think we need to push for more European actors to become more aggressive against Turkey and to find ways to isolate Erdogan and keep him from expanding his terror or the chaos that he likes to sow in the neighborhood. So, and I think that there's an ideological foundation for Europe to do that, because if Europe considers itself to be a place of democracy and human rights, then Europe needs to stand up for democracy and human rights within the Eastern Partnership. Armenia is part of the European Eastern Partnership, and so is Belarus. And it's time for Europe to make that partnership mean something in terms of democracy and human rights.
I can only fully agree with you. So I think this entire discussion gave us a wonderful overview of relevant actors and potential levers that can be utilized in this conflict. And especially what became quite clear through the course of our conversation, that Europe may hold the keys to a mediation or resolution of the conflict that is lasting. So the PUC, with a Canadian quote, is in your field, Europe. To my last question, assuming we will soon return, hopefully, to a ceasefire in which no more human lives are at risk, what message do you have to the Armenian people, to the diaspora, and to the international civic society or civic communities who are non-Armenian?
I want to say that my message is for everyone without regard to ethnicity. I don't need to speak directly to the Armenians and nor towards non-Armenians. I won't make that distinction. I will make my call based on a moral ground that it's about human rights and democracy. We are born As individuals, we have an innate sense of dignity and justice, and we know when that's infringed upon. And part of that is making choices for ourselves. We all seek the freedom to make choices for ourselves. And in making choices for ourselves, we develop as individuals. And the second layer to that is that we join in collectives, we join in communities, and as a community, we express ourselves also. We join in a community and we make collective decisions about how we collectively want to live our lives. And that is simply self-determination. Self-determination is nothing more than that, that a group that has a bond joins together, makes decisions for itself, imposed upon it by conquerors and by groups that want to seek and use the dominated group for their own advantage. And that's a human calling. And in order to preserve that self-determination and to preserve a democratic process by which we all participate, democracy is a process in which we're all given a chance to participate in making the collective decision about how we're going to live as a society and that needs to be preserved universally, because when we allow for authoritarianism to rule in any one place, it expands. Authoritarianism has to expand. Without expansion, it cannot survive. It is imperialism. And so we need to stand for democracy and human rights everywhere, and we need to find ways in which we can act locally, but think globally. For example, the City Council of Geneva voted on a resolution in support of the self-determination of the people of Artsakh, and it requested the federal government to freeze all the assets of the Aliyev family. This was a local act which pushes the federal government to at least investigate the Aliyev family and to investigate it for based on these charges of aggression and corruption, and to freeze the assets. In other words, when you're dealing with an oligarch who's a bully, you have to go after their money. So, but this is a local action. And the City Council of Geneva did this because people who live in Geneva, residents of Geneva, demanded that the City Council do this. So this is a good example about civil society acting locally and trying to have an impact on a national level, which will grow to have an impact on an international level, or at least regional level. So this is what we need people to do. We need each and every one of us to be inspired to participate. You need to participate. And we each can find creative ways to participate in saving ourselves and each other.
Vahan, very powerful word. And this is an unmistakable call for individuals to act, for civil society to act, to preserve and enable a global trajectory to peace and prosperity. We had a wonderful conversation, and we are very thankful to have you here at Faces of Armenia today, the second part. And thank you to you. Let us know if you have any other concluding remarks.
No, I thank everyone for their interest, attention, and I just encourage you to do something, and you know what you can do.